Good evening, everyone. Can you hear me all right? Yeah. I'm obviously sitting here in the gloom compared to you guys. It seems very bright there in the Zendo. This is about as much light as I have in here at the moment, so. Yeah. I guess I'll begin by pointing out something that maybe is already clear to all of us, all of you, and that is that all of our experience, moment to moment and day to day, actually draws from the inexhaustible source of our life. So, noticing a leaf on the ground, hearing a bird call or a dog barking, or the sound of a car going by, human voices, and so forth. All of these phenomena participate intimately in our life. And even though our kind of standard Western view is that those are simply sensory data that are arriving at us and that register in the sensorium various ways. That is a partial view. And it is just as much the case that our life arises to meet these phenomena as they come, as we encounter them. And this, I think, is quite important. And as we move through our day, we can let this remarkable body-mind, we can recognize that participation in a way that's actually quite encouraging and nourishing. So don't assume that this body-mind is the passive recipient of phenomena. It is an active participant. And this means that we are moving through a lively and enlivening universe, not just catching sensory phenomena as they go by. Maybe it's a little easier to appreciate that when we're sitting in stillness, when we're sitting in zazen. But it's just as accessible when we are out and about. So I would recommend inviting and cultivating that kind of awareness when we are actively engaged in our day And notice how that changes the tone of our experience. When I take my morning walk, my morning constitutional, I try to cultivate actively that practice. And even though the profound karma of body, speech, and mind asserts itself consistently, we can also meet it with this experience of a kind of wonder that some of our wonderful old poems also enshrine. So even now, as we're sitting together, the inexhaustible source of our lives is abundantly being drawn from, and in a sense, given to each other. So when we encounter one another, we are giving to each other of that life. It's also true of seeing a leaf, a tree, a dog. I don't know if you have the same Zoom view as I do, but one of the participants is wearing a very becoming orange scarf. I don't know if you can see that, but I would love to meet this participant sometime. This participant has a handsome, grizzled face, sort of like I would have if I let my beard grow. I'm not sure if you can see this chat, but Chanel is exchanging with us. This way of communicating with you guys, I find very unsatisfactory, and I'm hoping I can figure out some way of being with you in person instead. Given my ponderous karma that involved with travel, I haven't yet figured out how to do that, but that is my hope. So this way of experiencing our progress through the world is it's also rather I would say freeing. To freeze up something in our heart, to recognize how intimate is this ordinary way of being in the world, which we so often can take for granted. And if instead we realize that everything that happens draws from, reflects, and is reflected in our life, our being, it makes a difference. Speaking of freedom, on Facebook, I follow David Chadwick's posts from his marvelous website, Cuke.com. He's the David Chadwick's the author of the excellent book Crooked Cucumber, which I highly recommend if you haven't read it yet. It's quite excellent. Anyway, he's been quoting from a variety of Suzuki Roshi's Dharma talks. And the other day, the quote was something like, We must have freedom from ourself in order to have freedom from everything. And he says, to attain this kind of freedom is our practice. So I've been pondering that for some days now. What does it mean to have freedom from ourselves? And is that an attainment that we are actually cultivating? Well, Suzuki Roshi is not here to ask, although I imagine at the on the occasion of the talk that he gave, there were some questions. But it must be the case that freedom from ourself must involve an accurate perception of who and what we are. It's not something like, oh, we can somehow, you know, here's ourself, and we can somehow stand apart from it. That's clearly not the case. In Buddha's teaching, freedom from ourself would mean at the very least, manifesting the intention to realize that what is present is the five skandhas and nothing else. And the advice of the teaching is, if you find that you are, let's say, imagining that something else is present besides five skandhas, then by all means, examine carefully that experience and try to locate what this additional thing could possibly be that is not within the five skandhas. Another way to look at freedom from our self might be something like the end, the complete end of self-clinging. That's a, well, I'll say for me, it sounds like a very tall order. Traditionally speaking, if we are completely without self-clinging, we are then fully enlightened. I, of course, will make no such claim. I don't know about you guys. But self-clinging, if we regard it as a kind of variable of our life, it is heavily, heavily influenced by karma. And as you know, as Buddha taught, karma is not to be banished by just wishing it away. It cannot be banished by somebody else doing magic at you. It is sometimes said that great practitioners can influence the speed of the ripening of our karma. And the faster that can happen, the faster the influence of past karma will be exhausted. Years ago, when I attended His Holiness the Dalai Lama's teachings in San Jose, here nearby in the Bay Area, I was wearing robes, and so I was invited up onto the dais with the other monastics. And His Holiness was just a few feet away. And behind me were a couple of Tibetan lineage practitioners, but they were Westerners, and they were speaking English. And I heard them say, It's great being up here on the dais with His Holiness. One of them said, and the other one said, yes. Yeah, it is great. For some people though, that might mean that their karma would ripen so fast that they can't deal with it. And it might manifest as illness or psychological instability or something. So this is one point of view. That the speed of karmic ripening can be affected. But Buddha was pretty clear. No one else can take your karma away. The Buddha said something like, no matter if kalpa after kalpa has to pass for karmic ripening to take place, that will happen until at last, he said, the debt is paid. So somewhere in here is our freedom in there somewhere? Well, as Soan San was saying earlier, we can certainly meet the phenomena of our experience with patience. And in that unfolding of our experience, there will be the ripening of karma. And yes, probably to some extent, the generation of new karma. And in spite of all of that, here's Suzuki Roshi saying, to attain this freedom from everything by way of freedom from ourself is our practice. So this comes up with some frequency, I think, in the West, this question of freedom. And the mythology kind of is that the Zen adepts are these marvelously free beings. And as somebody said, they travel the six realms of existence in a samadhi of innocent delight. And if that sounds like your life, congratulations. I would make no such claim. And many of our Zen stories are held to illustrate being free in the midst of phenomena. This is not always so clear, but that's what they say. I was reading a story in the Blue Cliff Record collection, which you're probably familiar with. Story number 48 is called Turning Over the Kettle at Chaoqing. And in this tale, there's a character named Minister Wang. As a minister, he had a fairly significant role to play in the government, and he was in charge of a region. And there was a pretty substantial temple there called Zhaoqing. And being the minister, he could pretty much go here and there as he pleased and make sure everything was in order. So one day he decides to go to the temple. He was also a Zen man or a Zen person, a practitioner of Chan, as they would call it. And he makes his way into the temple and he sees one of the senior practitioners and the abbot, the master, who is named Ming Zhao. So Ming Zhao is making tea, or about to make tea, and Elder Yang, as he was known, Elder Yang is holding the kettle. Which, as I see it, at the time was empty. So the minister comes over. Probably reasonably expecting to be offered tea. But when he arrives, Elder Yang looks at him and flips the kettle upside down. So the minister is somewhat startled, but thinks, I know this game. So he says, what is under the tea table? And Elder Yang says, the spirit that's holding up the tea table. And the minister says, if it's the spirit that's holding up the tea table, why turn over the kettle? And Elder Yang shakes his head and says, 1,000 days as a minister, losing it all in one morning. The minister is not happy. He makes this gesture with his nice long sleeves, shakes them out, and leaves. Meanwhile, Abbot Ming Zhao is standing there with the tea, watching this, and he says to Elder Yang, you have received nourishment here at Zhaoqing, and yet you still cross the river and make a racket collecting charred wood. Elder Yang, who up to then had been pleased with himself, says, well, how about you, teacher? And Ming Zhao says, that spirit wins the point. And he puts down the tea and walks away. So where is the freedom from self in there? I don't know. I don't know, so I wrote a short poem for this story. There was a great temple at Jiaoqing. If you ask, how is it now? I'll say, gone without a trace. If you ask, where will we worship then? I will silently offer tea to the faithful. So where is the freedom in all this? The freedom from the self. Well, again, I don't know. But I would suggest that our effort should be to observe clearly at all times. And to know that there is nothing present that is not the five skandhas. And apply that truth of analysis relentlessly to our experience. And to the degree that our misknowledge of what our life and body mind are can be worn away by clear observation, there will be freedom of the self. And if Suzuki Roshi is right, that means freedom from everything. Probably if I sit here long enough in my gloomy chamber, I could think of more to say, but mostly I've learned to trust that when there's a silence inside, it means it's time to shut up. If I were there with you, maybe I could silently serve you tea. That would be fun. But maybe now I'll just have to ask for questions or comments.
Reverend Mio, it's Larry. Good evening.
Good evening, Larry.
And thank you very much for that talk. I am curious about your statement that clearly observe if there's anything other than the five skandhas, and that practice might be connected to the idea of freedom from self. Now, several of those skandhas, I think one is formation, mental formations. I think that's karmic activity, if I understand correctly. And another is consciousness, which, as I understand it, is dualistic consciousness. And within those two skandhas, there seems to be a lot of opportunity for not being able to see clearly. So I'm confused by the idea that, if I understand you correctly, that being able to realize there's nothing outside of the five skandhas is an aid towards freedom from self.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if I got what your confusion is, but I think you referred to the samskara, skandha.
Yeah.
And consciousness, or vijnana, which is, most simply put, awareness as an element of our experience. Are you saying that the functioning of the skandhas is such that it will obscure our effort to see clearly? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I would say that's actually not so. And that if you believe that to be true, subject that to analytical study as well. What is that conclusion made of? What is that sense based on? And is it based on anything outside of the five skandhas? This sort of analytical thinking is highly prized in certain Buddhist circles anyway, as an antidote to wrong view. And the only glue, if you will, for self-clinging is wrong view. There is no other. So please ask again if you wish, but that's how it looks to me.
I will continue that practice that you suggest. I suppose what I'm getting at is that there are some skandhas that seem to be rife with the creation of the three poisons or other delusional thinking or activity.
Mm-hmm. And those creations are nothing but the five skandhas again.
Yeah.
So the suggestion is to turn back again and again and again. That this sort of clear observation and see if you can come up with anything else, anything that is not the five skandhas. And of course, Buddha said, you can't, you won't be able to.
Oh, but, I think something clicked in me there.
Oh, yeah. Very good. Very good.
All right. Well, that's very helpful then. Thank you for helping me through this.
You're welcome.
Reverend Mio, this is Sarah.
Hi, Sarah.
How are you? It's good to see you as always. I'm reading a really interesting book on free will, and it's a subject I have a lot of interest in and have read other books. This is a wonderful book. It's called Determined by a neuroscientist, Robert Salofsky, I think his name is.
Yeah, I've heard of him.
Yeah, he's quite an entertaining author. He actually, what's really interesting, he serves as a expert witness in trials of people who have committed horrible crimes, and serves as witness about their lives and what kind of things have happened in their lives, the family they were raised with, either that were neurologically damaging and contributed to the fact that they really didn't have a choice about committing this crime, that they were so damaged that they couldn't have done otherwise. And it's a fascinating read. And I've read other things about free will where they say, we don't really have a free will in the way that we talk about it in common parlance. And what really struck me is was the kalpa after kalpa after kalpa as karma ripens. This is what he's describing in his book about the mechanics of how that happens. Mm-hmm. So your talk today made me go back to think a little bit more about two things. First of all, why is it that we as human beings cling to this idea that we freely choose? That I am in control of my fate, for example, or I choose to do this or that, and it's my choice. Why is it, what is that karmic impulse? And it comes back to me from your talk. It's that clinging to that I'm an independent self that can navigate this world. Mm-hmm. And so then the next question comes up, and I'm thinking about this just in neuropsychological terms at this point, but it's always fascinating to me about how Buddhist philosophy is so congruent with what we are learning in terms of neuroscience and science in general. So I guess I'm struggling now to try to apply your talk to what I've been learning. And I'm thinking it's this idea of looking back and reflecting in what are those karmic influences in my life that are in my own experience and in the experience of my parents and the environment that I grew up in that make me act in such a determined way where I don't have free will per se, but I do things and act in ways that may or may not be beneficial. And it's that instead of just letting those neurons fire and going off, it's circling back, I think is what I heard you say, and observing that process or that self or what it was that happened to try to tease out those karmic influences that were involved in my experience. And I think that's what I was hearing you say, or can you help me move a little further along this path to make sure I'm not veering off?
Well, that's quite a complex presentation you just made. So one way I would look at this is, first of all, Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, did not teach that there's no free will. He did not teach that. Obviously, if there's no free will, there's no liberation. So he did not teach that. The label, the samskara skandha, is merely a way of speaking of the tendency of consciousness to approach what is desirable and shy away from what is undesirable. That's all it means. And when we talk about the ripening of karma, if we look at an authoritative source like the Abhidharma Kosha, there's not much to it. For instance, the ripening of, you might call, an unwholesome karma, difficult karma, obscuring karma, is held to be like a feeling arising in the body-mind that is distinctly unpleasant, something like maybe feeling like a sunburn or a bad case of poison oak or ants crawling around or something, that emerges and passes away relatively quickly. And the ripening of positive karma is the opposite. Registering in the body mind of a feeling of ease or pleasure or something pleasant. So that's a fairly simple way of constructing how karma manifests, and we tend to make it much more elaborate in our thinking in the West. Sometimes we equate karma, we make it the same as cause and effect, which it isn't. So, here's Shakyamuni, who does not teach that there's no free will. Here are various scientific authorities. And I know this is one of my hobby horses, but I can't help it, who are attempting to analyze and understand this body-mind using nothing but this body-mind, as though it were possible to stand outside it and figure out how it's really working. You can't do that. You yourself are a body-mind. So what makes people think that we are going to be able to analyze the enormous, complicated variety of physiological, neurological functions and derive a definitive explanation of our being, of ourself, makes no sense to me at all. So I want to say at the outset that I respect our neurologists, but there is something very odd about what they're doing. So, you probably recall that, step number two, not step, but topic number two in the Noble Eightfold Path is what? What do we call that? Something like, anybody? What's the second of the Eightfold Path? I can't hear you.
Intention, I believe.
Intention. Something like that. So if we have no free will, then there is no intention. that means anything. So Buddha obviously thought that to intend to follow the path of what we've called, we sometimes call, or could be called, the path of mercy and freedom for all beings. We can actually intend that. We can intend that to be the case. And whether someone chooses to see that, for instance, as there are numbers of physicists, some anyway, who insist, oh, there's no free will. It's all, you know, quarks making you do certain things. It's like, yeah, you know what? You can't know that. And what are you using to know that? More quarks. You can't get outside that. What makes you think you're going to explain it all from the midst of it? I don't get that. So I'm trying to get at your question in a way that, from my point of view, recognizes that the story about how eventually we will unravel everything that's true about this body mind from the point of view of this body mind doesn't make sense to me. Therefore, to declare that there is no free will because of quarks makes no sense to me. So therefore, I can't exactly join you where you are standing, Sarah, if I have understood, and I don't, maybe I didn't.
No, I think you did.
I don't want to get too complicated, because this does get very complicated. So I'm trying to, as much as possible, refer to Buddha's teaching, which is actually pretty clear, and therefore, in that way, helpful. So, but please ask further if you wish.
No, I totally see what you're saying, Reverend Mio, I hear what you're saying, and that idea of that intention, that where does that intention come from? And I do think it's worth examining that question.
Mm-hmm.
Where did that intention come from?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, very often it takes me to my past and, you know, or different psychological needs that I have as an individual that come from my karma. So that intention comes in clothed with lots and lots of strings, I should say, maybe is another word to say of it. So, it's what you do with all of those strings and pieces and what your understanding of those strings and pieces are and whether they're wholesome or unwholesome, whether they are helpful or unhelpful, I think is maybe where that a bit of light comes in, that your intention arises there. But, you know, I think that's really the challenge, because I do think what the neuroscientists are telling us about how deterministic our behaviors are in many, many ways does have a physical basis. I think the difference for me is, what do I do then with that knowledge of where those forces and those karmic seeds came from and how they are growing?
Well, as I say, this discussion could go on quite a bit longer, but maybe what I would also point out is that what we call intention comes from what is sometimes called Buddha nature. And I don't know whether our neurologist friends would find that meaningful, but I do. just as I find it profoundly meaningful to have Buddha say, all beings, their whole being is Buddha nature. This is a remarkable insight of his. Anyway, yes.
Miyo-san, this is Shokan.
Hello, Shokan.
Your talk brought to mind one you gave here at the Dharma Center a number of years ago on the subject of freedom. And my takeaway from that was that the one true freedom that we have is the freedom to refrain. You know, like it's my choice whether or not to take up any volitional action. It's sort of like the same thing I tell my kids to save their money, because once they've spent it, you know, their freedom is gone. And I think it's kind of the same thing.
That is one way to look at it. We are certainly able not to do, which of course is Suzuki Roshi's prescription for the precepts. To see potentially problematic words and deeds from the point of view of, don't do it. This was his very simple and trenchant understanding. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Well, it is nearly 9, but maybe one more question.
Hello, Reverend Myo. It's Parvriti Dorali.
Hello there.
Well, a subtle conversation, and I guess one thought that I'm having is that perhaps what you mean by observing is sort of like the via negativa process, where I'm noticing exactly what is happening inside in terms of my response to a situation, for example, and seeing my own reactivity, which I would understand to be a kind of karmic pattern. But in that via negativa, there's this moment of openness that then arises. And then the attention would be to step into that openness.
And I would say that openness is intrinsic to the situation. Something like that.
Say a little more, please.
I think that's enough for that particular point right now.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, well, that was a lot of work. The fact that you are all still patiently sitting is an excellent sign. And for me, I do not find it illuminating to think, oh yeah, they all don't have any choice. They're just compelled by quarks or something. Like, yeah, I don't find that very interesting or useful. So, I'm reminded of the traditional sign-off that tends to be spoken by the modern day followers of Aleister Crowley, whom some of you probably heard of, who has a unjustifiably bad reputation, or had, but he's long since passed away. Anyway, nowadays, a lot of the followers of what's called Thelema, which was his very interesting novel religion, they say, one guy whom I very much like says, please look after yourself, look after each other, do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. Love is the law, love under will. Maybe we can close with that.